Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At the popular law student online forum Auto Admit, things could get pretty rough. Raunchy, vicious, racist, personal. When two female Yale Law School students caught the forum's attention, attackers had a field day. Just tore them up online. It was intimate. It was harsh. The women felt they could not escape, that they and their careers were being damaged. They sued. This hour, On Point: free speech, extreme cyber harassment, and how this case may change the rules. Joining me first today from New York is David Margalek, contributing editor at Portfolio Magazine, where his article Slimed Online appears this month. David Margalek, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
Tell us the story.
Well, the story is basically that two Yale law students, two women at Yale Law School, woke up separately and found themselves the subject of vicious attacks online on a website they barely had heard of called Auto Admit. Somebody had posted something about each of them separately at different times in the last few years. And a free-for-all sort of resulted, where one person would try to top the other by saying outrageous or outlandish or obnoxious things about them, commenting on their sexual promiscuity, commenting on their honesty, fantasizing about raping them or doing other various things to them, just one comment after another. And these women didn't know who the people were who were attacking them, didn't know what to do, didn't know how to stop them, were sort of flummoxed, went to the law school authorities, tried other various things, and eventually ended up trying to find out who their attackers were and sue them in court.
Why were they attacked? Why were they singled out? Is it clear?
It's not really clear. It doesn't take much of an impetus. I think that in one case, it was somebody who had dated a woman named Britton Heller, who was entering Yale Law School, somebody who had known her at Stanford, and obviously it had was frustrated or had tried to date her or was, you know, it seemed to be a jilted suitor of some sort, and who was unhappy with her, just posted something notifying people at Yale Law School that she was going to be in the first year class and to watch out for her. And that's really all the prompting that people need. Once they have a name, they can start attacking you, even if, again, you know, 99% of them, unlike the person who started the whole thing, had no idea who this woman was.
So Britton Heller and Heidi Iravani.
Heidi Iravani. Mm-hmm. It happened with Heidi Iravani, also a Yale law student, after she was already at Yale. And it seemed as if in that instance, it was one of her fellow students who posted a picture of her online. And the merrymaking, quote unquote, started after that. Again, somebody she may well have been sitting next to in her class. She had no idea who started the whole thing, but it doesn't take much, and it's a cyber snowball after that.
You call them hyper accomplished women. The attacks were hyper harsh once they got going. Give us a sense of the volume and detail of what was being piled up online.
Well, these things would happen in what are known as threads, where one person would start a conversation and it would just sort of ensue from there. And one person would say, I want to rape her. And then there would be various people would build on fantasies and sort of elaborate on what they wanted to do to one or the other of these women. Or there would be a comment on their breasts. And there'd be speculation over whether their breasts were real or not and the various things that one could do with them. That was one kind of thread. In another instance, one of the women had a father who had problems with the law, and somebody pulled up an article in the Washington Post about his case, and then there was all kinds of comments about that. There were other threads in which people talked about How one of them had cheated to get into Yale Law School, that her LSATs, her law boards, were humiliatingly low, but that she had gotten in anyway. And how could she have gotten in? Well, she had had a lesbian affair with the dean of admissions.
So
I mean, that sort of gives you a feeling of some of the kinds of comments that were on there.
Did the women then make the case? I mean, you can see how this would be emotionally difficult, but did they make the case that there were factual claims here that would be harmful to them, to their careers, to their, I don't know, earning capacity over a lifetime? Is that how they came back at this?
Well, that was one of them. Britton Heller made that claim very early on that even though the cyber stalking had subsided, by the time she was at Yale Law School, that these were the claims were the first things that came up in a Google search of her, and so that prospective employers would punch her name into Google, and all of a sudden they'd read that she was a terrible bitch and that she'd cheated her way into Yale Law School, and to watch out for her, and that she had herpes and various other things. And this is the first thing that they would see. And lawyers are a cautious bunch, and they're very concerned about the image of their law firms and what their clients think. And if they had reason to fear that their clients would also Google search their lawyers and see this sort of thing, well, was this the kind of person that they wanted to hire for their firms? So Heller claimed in an early version of the case, in the initial complaint, that she had applied to 16 different law firms for summer jobs after her first year of school, and that all of them turned her down. And as I say in the story, you know, Yale Law School is the hardest law school in the country to get into. It's the most prestigious elite law school in the country. And it's absolutely inconceivable that somebody would apply to 16 different law firms and not get a single offer. Other people, I should add, found this claim inherently dubious, simply because this raises the whole question of whether people actually believe things that appear online, and that's a whole separate issue.
Yes, indeed.
And she later dropped that claim.
A big question in itself. You describe how they tried to push back against this before the law was brought fully into play here, and how difficult that is, given the way things are set up, given the statutes that surround the way information is distributed online. I mean, they went first to the site itself and tried to get some relief there from what was piling up, and then they tried to go further. How did they attempt to sort of clean up their what Google results online?
Well, they went for. I mean, I think that they realize, as any entering law student would, that the law is a very blunt instrument here, and the law has not really adapted to this set of circumstances. And so, their first approach was suasion, was to contact the people at the website, very politely in each instance, and say, please take this stuff down, and. The administrators of the law site realize that under the law they're not liable. They cannot be sued. Google and various carriers of information, not originators of information, but carriers cannot be sued for what they carry. The intent of the law was to encourage the free flow of information, and they're immunized under the law, so they don't have to do anything.
This is Section 230C of the Communications Decency Act of 1996. They're not responsible.
What I call the greatest misnomer on the law books now. And so they turned to these people, and the problem there is that because the people who administered the AutoAdmit website weren't required to do anything, they were very sensitive when people demanded that they do something, and it was very easy to tell these people just to buzz off. And they were particularly tempted to do that when they felt as if they were being leaned on or coerced or bullied. They were very sensitive about this. There's this whole free speech sensitivity on the web, and there are a lot of free speech absolutists who feel that anything goes, and, you know, they'll be damned if they knuckle under to elite law students with thin skin.
Free speech and champions here, to the point that they stopped collecting IP addresses of those who were posting, so there really was no easy way to track them down, even if they tried. But eventually the suit was brought. On what grounds, and how did they do it when most of the posters would have been anonymous, apart from their online handles?
Well, they sued for defamation and invasion of privacy, an intentional infliction of emotional distress. They named all of the individual plaintiffs by their handles you know, Wham-O and Sleazy Z and the Ayatollah of rock and roll, as I say. Mm-hmm. These names look very weird when they jump off the pages of a legal brief. And they didn't know who any of these people were, but they thought that with the authority of the court is empowered to issue subpoenas to the Internet service providers and the websites trying to find out who these people are. And, in fact, the protections are rather flimsy. And if the information is available, it will be turned over to the plaintiffs with quite a minimal showing of to the court. The problem is that in most of these instances, these people could not be outed because their IP addresses had deliberately not been saved or had been erased during periodic scrubbings that the Internet service providers carry out.
But you've got a big, gnarly case here with plenty of defendants or those that they've gone after. Some of them, at least one of them, now countersuing. We'll hear on that front. And you say right at the outset, David Margolick, that this may help change the rules. Really? That the Communications Decency Act of 1996 going to be changed as a result of this? Or?
Well, I think that it's a very long row for this to be changed. I mean, they'll have to go up against Google and Microsoft and various mighty companies that will lobby incredibly strenuously and throw their legal and corporate weight around before this law is changed.
But the case throws a big bright light on what's going on in some of the darker corners of the Internet. David Margolick in New York with Portfolio Magazine. Please stand by. There's a lot more we want to hear from both sides here. We're talking about extreme cyber harassment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. About extreme cyber harassment. David joins us from New York. David, bring us to the bottom line here. In this legal action that they've taken, did they get satisfaction? What kind of case was it? Did they get damages? Where does it stand?
Well, technically, the case is still very early. It's early on. I mean, it hasn't. Mm-hmm. No trial date has been set, and it's still in the discovery phase. But there have been some developments because the women have managed to identify at least a handful of the defendants in the case, and they have considerable leverage. One can argue that legally their cases are quite weak. It's hard to prove defamation. Many of the statements that were made were opinions rather than facts. These cases are very hard to win, but they have, once they identify these people, they have the power to out them and ruin their professional careers. They can hold that over these people and coerce settlements out of them, leading some of the lawyers for some of the defendants to say that this is essentially a stick-up and that some of the people who made really quite innocuous comments have had settlements coerced out of them. So several of the defendants have quietly given the plaintiffs a few $1,000s in order to go away, and that's where the case stands now. It's quite – there's one instance, one of the defendants – is fighting this. An undergraduate, a recent graduate of the University of Texas, is actually willing to go to court, and theoretically the case could be a full-blown battle in court in his instance, and there it might actually make new law. But otherwise, the case is still in its very early stages.
We're going to hear from one who tried to push back, but before we do, Daniel Citrin joins us from Baltimore, Maryland, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. She's written extensively on cyber harassment and the law. Professor Citrin, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
What's the dynamic that you see having developed in some of these rough, sometimes very rough, corners of the web?
Yeah, you know, it's what's so dangerous here is that what we're seeing is sort of anonymous mobs coming together, that if we take each threat, lie, in the abstract, just take it by itself, it may seem innocuous, but all together, the threats, sort of the hundreds of sexually explicit threatening statements and lies all together, and emails that were in fact sent to former and prospective law firms and employers, including alleged lies about the women, that all together, you know, impair women's economic opportunities and really chill their free speech and willingness to be online.
Anybody can be beaten up online, but you do draw a line between online harassment, extreme harassment, and women in particular. What's the dynamic you see there?
Yeah, you know, 80% of all cyber harassment cases, their victims are women. And what we see is it's a really gender-specific harm. Threats of violence include rape threats, often giving women's home addresses with the suggestion that they should be raped or strangled. We see doctored photographs of women being posted online, them being raped and strangled. And so what we're seeing is a very gendered nature of the harm, both in the choice of the victim and then a kind of the very sexually explicit, threatening, treating women as sexual objects kind of harm.
Professor Citrin, David Margalek, stand by. I want to begin to bring in some of our listeners here. Bonnie is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Bonnie, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad to speak about this because I have a daughter who's a freshman in college, mm-hmm. and I read in the Globe about something called Juicy Campus. So I looked it up, and she was in there, and I called her. I was horrified.
What is it?
It's a place anonymously where you can go campus by campus across the United States, and then you look for someone's name to see if there's any comments about them. It's almost, as your last person said, all women, and they're very lascivious, ugly comments or comments on how the women look, almost always negative, and by totally anonymous people. I believe Juicy Campus has been taken down.
But was it bad enough that it seemed to you to be wrong, to be outside the bounds of appropriate free speech, or just, you know, rough and tumble world we live in, Bonnie?
Pretty rough and tumble, and not wrong, I suppose. No, I think it's wrong. But what was really wrong is the anonymousness of the victims are there with their name, their campus, mm-hmm. their year, and the people signing on and giving the very, very ugly comments are all totally anonymous. And so that does seem out of bounds to me, absolutely.
My daughter said
you can't fight back. If you fight back, you stay at the top of the list. So being a smart cookie, she let herself drift to the bottom.
Wow. Bonnie, thank you for your call. Daniel Citrin, you also draw a line between what you see online and old sort of mob dynamics from anti-immigrant riots or even the Ku Klux Klan.
That's right, because, Tom, you said, look, is this something that's just the rough and tumble of, you know, daily life? And I think in certain cases, it's absolutely, you know, we can't ask women to say, look, it's the Wild West, get over it or go offline. What happens is when women are attacked, they stop sort of availing themselves of all the economic opportunities online that everyone else is, you know, men are able to enjoy without any threats of violence. And so women should not be asked to go offline, as it sounds like Bonnie's daughter didn't respond, didn't attempt to resuscitate her reputation, mm-hmm. Sort of quietly skulk away. And then in some cases, like in the AutoAdmit case, the attacked women stopped going to the gym. There were posters would say, look, I saw her at the gym. She was wearing this. Someone take a picture of her. So stop going to the gym. I mean, women's lives are very directly affected, both socially and then economically.
You say 80% of those attacked online are women. It's worse than just cyberbullying. It's harassment, and yeah. it has a cost, emotional and financial. Let's get a call from Patrick in Florence, South Carolina. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm Patrick. I'm actually a free speech advocate. I'm a frequent user of Slashdot and FARC and several IRCs, which are basically internet forums. And, you know, I am concerned about, you know, people trying to limit what we're saying online. And what one of the young callers earlier said, you know, that posters shouldn't be anonymous. But let me ask you this. If you're an employee of a company, and you post a comment about how horrible it is to work there, but you don't want to be recorded so that you can't be fired.
Yep.
Well, if these people are forcing you to have your IP recorded, then they can track you down, figure out who said something bad about the company, and fire you.
Right. I totally understand that. What about when it's individuals that come under attack, Patrick? Maybe young men, maybe young women. And you know, if you're on there, you know how tough it can be. Does that look like a problem to you or not?
I mean, honestly, actually, yes, sometimes people do go too far. And for instance, in this case, y'all were mentioning that addresses were being given out. Yes, it's too far, but at the same time, it's a, not really, should not be regulated. Because as soon as you start saying, no, you can't say this, someone will say, well, you can't say that, you can't say this, you can't say that.
Patrick, we've got it. Let me put it to Daniel Citron. Daniel, what do you say? I mean, there's so much that goes on the web. So much of life is lived there. I'm looking at this auto admit site right now, and there's a lot that's just regular stuff about what kind of grades you need to get in here or there. But then there is woven right through it really, really rough stuff. One of the top dozen sort of threads here, do Bobby Jindal's daughters bleep, bleep? And it is as bad as it gets. But is that just okay? You hear Patrick, he says, come on, free speech,
right?
Why not?
Right, and Patrick, I share your interest in sort of allowing an enormous amount of free speech online, and what we're seeing is these anonymous mobs are silencing women, so that the concern for free speech is also, it's not a clash of civil rights and civil liberties, but in fact civil liberties on both sides of the coin, that women are literally being forced offline, they're prevented from speaking. And I think it's really important to see the free speech implications from the victim's point of view.
What do you make of the particular... David, please.
Tom, yeah. if I can chime in. I mean, I think that the Bonnie's story from Boston is instructive in the sense that these people moved on eventually. They're like locusts, and they move on to the next target. And to some degree, this problem corrects itself. People come and go, and people are attacked and then not attacked any longer. And I think that, with all due respect to Danielle, whom I interviewed for the story and whom I quote in the story, I think that these problems can be exaggerated. I mean, do we know, for instance, whether Bonnie's daughter stopped going online? I rather doubt that she stopped going online. She sort of just let nature take its course, and these sort of cyber predators moved on to the next target.
Where did you come down in the case of Britton Heller and Heidi Iravani? Did it look like much ado about not so much, or did it look a real complaint here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were very badly hurt, and they were badly bloodied. But I don't think that a lot of the things that were said about them were legally actionable. And one has to view this in the context of the cyber culture. And a lot of what's said online can instantly be discounted because everybody knows that in that realm, it's a hyperbolic, extreme realm, and that an awful lot of the stuff that goes on in there, while not very pleasant, is discreditable.
I want to bring on a couple of other folks who play into this story, if I may, right now. David Margalek, Daniel Citron, please stand by. First, joining us from the U.S. Virgin Islands is Anthony Scioli, a University of Pennsylvania Law School graduate who worked for the message board AutoAdmit. He joins us today from the Virgin Islands, U.S. Virgin Islands. Anthony Scioli, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Also with us from Orlando, Florida, is Mark Randazza, attorney who represented Anthony Scioli, adjunct professor at Barry University School of Law in Florida. His blog is The Legal Satyricon. Mark Randazza, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Great to be here.
Anthony, you worked for this site when Britton Heller and Heidi Iravani were complaining about the way they were being described and treated there. What did you think of their complaints?
Well, yes, I worked for AutoAdmit from around 2004 to March 2007 as chief education director. I should just briefly clarify that I was not in charge of the message board. My role at AutoAdmit was to administer the AutoAdmit studies section, where, among other things, we examined placement at elite law firms by various law schools.
Right, but you did hear from these two, I think. If David Margalek's story gets it right, what did you think?
Well, I honestly think they had a lot of valid complaints.
You did or didn't?
I believe they did have valid complaints, and mm-hmm. I recommend to Jared that the threads be taken down in both instances.
This was Jared Cohen, who's the founder, owner of the site?
Correct.
Did they come down? Did anything come down?
In this particular instance, I believe Jared had said that they were going to come down in early March, but then after all the media coverage and as David had said earlier, once reputation defenders started to put significant pressure, Jared seemed to believe they didn't want to be bullied into taking them down.
Now, Heidi in Britain said that their careers were being negatively affected by this. What about your own career? You were ultimately named. I guess you've been dropped, but you were named in their suit. Has it had an impact of you having been involved in this whole picture?
Well, it should go without saying that my career has been impacted as a result of the all of this. I mean, I have to say I really enjoy my job here at the Virgin Islands. I'm doing some of the most interesting work that an attorney of my level of experience could be doing, and I'm really making the best out of the situation. But honestly, I would have preferred to be at Edwards Angel, Palmer & Dodge.
You had an offer from Palmer & Dodge, as I understand, that was rescinded after it came to light that you'd been involved with in this auto admit business.
Correct.
Mark Randazza, you represented Anthony Cilli when he was a defendant, I guess. What do you make of what happened here? Where's the wrong?
Well, there's a couple of wrongs. I agree that these girls were mobbed. It looked like it started back in 2005. And as noted, David, I love the comparison to a herd of locusts. You know, they went through, everybody forgot about this until a Washington Post piece in 2007 that sadly lacked much of your journalistic integrity. At that point, it began to float up again, and I think that was when this organization, Reputation Defender, got involved.
This is a group that helps try to, they try to help people who feel they're under attack online.
Well, that's how they market themselves.
Okay.
I have, you know, in my research, it has seemed that in many circumstances, they simply make it worse. Really, you know, what happened to Bonnie's daughter? Bonnie's daughter seemed to address this the right way. Let it go. Let it drop to the bottom. Everyone forgets about it, and it disappears. Now, I'm not saying that everybody
But is that really true when the Google search still brings it up, when you're looking for that summer internship and it says, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on about your sexual proclivities, how you, I mean, I can't even repeat almost
sure.
anything here, but is that really true that it just drops to the bottom?
It does. If you dig low enough into Google results for my name, mm-hmm. you're going to find that I'm a terrorist. I'm an Islamic member of the Taliban. You'll find any number of negative things about me, none of which are true. However, the positive information out there about me, the true information out there about me, rises to the top.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, should they have simply let it go? Maybe not. When someone is defamed, they certainly have a right to seek legal redress. Unfortunately, I think that the way they did it was so such a scattergun approach that they really destroyed their own interests. Some of these comments were absolutely horrible. And, you know, I have a mother, I have a daughter, I have a wife, I have a sister, and I would hate to see these things said about them. But some of the other things were completely innocuous. You know, Mr. Cilli didn't post a single thing. And was a defendant in this suit for no reason except they were seeking, you know, seeking to stick up other people. There was another defendant who was named a horse walked into a bar, and you know all he said in one comment was that he would make an ice cream sundae. Another one beat
out of these girls or one of them, I believe, right? I mean,
sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, when somebody says, you know,
with
hey,
sprinkles
take a look
here and
girl.
Sprinkles there, and yeah.
Right, if somebody says, take a look at this girl, and someone says, well, stalk her, well, that person, I think, is engaged in what we would call a true threat. And that has ways to be dealt with under our current legal regime. However, when somebody says, take a look at this picture, and someone writes, I'd pour syrup on that, and they wind up a defamation defendant, you know, I think that the accuracy of the tool used to cure the remedy has been way too blunt.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about extreme cyber harassment and a critical case that may change what you can say online. David, let me come back to you for a moment because you've written this up in great detail. You heard Attorney Randazza say, you know, hey, somebody says online, I'd like to pour syrup on that. How bad is it? In the context of everything that happened, what do you say to that, David?
Well, I agree with him. I agree with Mark on this point that I think that a lot of the people who made these comments, they're sort of juvenile. They're very immature. They can be obnoxious, but that's all that they are. And one of the problems with the lawsuit that the two women filed is that all of these people are lumped together, and there are very few distinctions made between the people who really said, legally actionable things about stalking them or making claims, for instance, that they had sexually transmitted diseases, which is libelous per se under the law. And the distinctions are not made between those kinds of statements and just these frivolous frat boy rants that people like a horse who walked into a bar made. And there's no distinctions made between them.
Daniel Citrin, first, on the facts, when you look at what went up in this thread on these two young women, was this just middle school, you know, locker room stuff? Ice cream sundaes and pouring syrup makes it sound that way.
Right. And for that comment, viewed in isolation, and I agree with Mark and David, but when we look at so many other of the threads online, I think Mark is right to invoke the true threats doctrine, that the First Amendment does not immunize true threats. And so I think, for example, the post, "I will force myself on her and sodomize her repeatedly," another person said, "she deserves to be raped so that her little fantasy world can be shattered by real life. I want to rape her in the bleep." And the threads at the same time suggesting that the posters had access to the women by noting what they wore at the law school gym and providing sort of updates on the sightings of the women. I mean, I think we can make a really strong argument that that's a true threat that's not immunized from liability. And I think it really trivializes precisely what went on here to say, to just focus in on that one statement about, gee, she's a sundae and I'd like to eat her up or something like that.
Attorney Randazza, do you see a true threat in those thread comments? And are they actionable under the law as it stands today?
I could certainly see some of them being interpreted that way. Also, you know, just to look at it, I don't have a dog in this fight anymore, so if I were sitting in the middle of this judging it, I could also say that they aren't true threats because of the context that they're in. You know, a lot of this online stuff, it's not for us grown-ups. These are kids who are not, we're what I call digital immigrants. These are digital natives. And some of this stuff is just shtick. You know, if you look at Borat's not really a racist, Borat's not really a sexist, and Borat's not really an anti-Semite. A lot of these online monikers are merely shticks. They're merely characters, and they're in some very juvenile, drawn-out play, but that's how they interact with each other. Now, I'm not trying to say that it is frivolous to call these a true threat, but that's a matter of fact that has to be determined at trial, and I am not 100% convinced that they are. So there really is another side to this that I think we need to consider, and that is the actual community where we're sitting. You know, you'll sit sometimes in a certain bar, you might hear somebody say,
"Yeah,
I'm going to smack that punk." They're not really going to do anything. This is just how people talk.
David Margulik, what do you make of that?
Years old, you know, yeah. I realize that I'm not really part of that generation. It feels terrible to be old and have to say kids, but that's part of this.
David, You looked at what came out here. I mean, these were real people. Maybe they're kids. I don't know. When you're in law school or out of law school, I mean, some of these identities finally came out, and they had people at the University of Iowa, Brigham Young University, at Yale itself, I guess. Were these kids? Is this just juvenilia, kind of shtick of the digital natives? Never mind, blow it off.
Well, I think that an awful lot of it is, and I think that one sure indication that it is when you consider the professional consequences to the two women. As I say, I mean, they were terribly bloodied and went through an awful ordeal, and no one would deny that. But one of them was hired by one of New York's top law firms, Cleary Gottlieb, and the other is working for the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which is very much the kind of work that she liked to do. And clearly, Cleary Gottlieb learned very quickly to discount whatever appeared on Heidi Iravani online. And I think the whole culture is learning how to do this. We're neophytes at this. This is a whole new form of discourse. And it's just as Mark says, I think that people who are not familiar with it, who come into it, are shocked at what they read. But gradually, we're going to get used to this.
Daniel Citrin, what about it? With those jobs at a top New York firm, at the Hague, I mean, do the facts say they're okay? No harm, no foul. This is just a new era. The stuff is terrible. I mean, what you were citing there, it's absolutely terrible. But is that now somehow just okay, chaff, it blows by?
Absolutely not. And in fact, some of these comments suggest to me that still the profound pull of completely detrivializing what is happening. We can't discount the emotional harm that no doubt these women suffered. We can't discount some of the reputational consequences of being said that you have a low LSAT, that you've been in drug rehab, and herpes, even if they've landed on their feet, they're brilliant women who went to Yale Law School. But let's take women who are not so accomplished as these two women were. They're attacked online, they can't recover. And I think it's really important to not just focus on this case, that we have countless of examples of women bloggers who are attacked online with technology, you know, attacks that force them offline, with doctored photographs of them being raped and strangled, so that women are silenced, emotionally distraught, deprived of their ability to write in their own names. They have to assume male pseudonyms so they can go online. And I think we cannot understate the significance of this cyber gender harassment.
Let's hear from a woman in Nashville, Tennessee. Catherine, you're on the line. Catherine, on the air.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate you taking the call. Sure. I have been attacked this way, and I say it's attack. It's a lot different from gossip around the water cooler because this is permanent. It's in print. I was a whistleblower on an assault case that happened in a small city here in Nashville, and there was a building inspector who didn't pass a house. It was not to code. It was a fire code issue, and they beat her up. And the city told her to bury it, and I was the whistleblower.
Wow.
Went to the mayor, you know, it was very political.
Okay.
And the actual city manager has a website of dirt on the city, and it's Googled by everyone. And eventually they fired me, you know, and I have a great-looking resume. I have all these great-looking things, and people will not touch me.
And
know,
why? What happened online, Catherine, that's giving you that trouble? What was your sliming?
They put online that I was a terror. They put online that I was a liar. They put online that I was in this just for the money. And I, you know, it took a long time to actually file a suit, and there is a lawsuit now against the city, and it's just a lot of it was just trying to get them to take the website down, you know, like take it down, take my name off it. I have a header on the website, so when people Google me, but, it you know, they pull all this up. It pulls up, they, you know, they cut and paste. They put a lot of things that are not true.
But in your case, did they get into this kind of sexual, you know, terrorizing, or was it just comments about your character, and are those fair game?
Well, no, because I was not a public person. I mean, it wasn't something, number one, it's not true, and there's no way to fight it. You know, I mean, you guys talk about free speech. I don't have free speech. I can't get on this website. They won't post me.
And so,
you know,
it's up there, you blew the whistle, and now you pay and pay online.
I pay and I can't get it off. And this has gone on for years, and it keeps igniting. You know, they'll put it in the papers, and they quote this. I mean, I have attorneys that go on there and quote this website. So, and it's not true. They're using it as fact because it's in writing. So,
Catherine, we appreciate you sharing your story, and I want to get one more right here. But thank you, Catherine, in Nashville, Tennessee, in Quakertown, Pennsylvania. Holly. Hi, Holly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My situation is a lot different than the kind that you're talking about because it was not sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 58 years old. There's a widow support site that is absolutely excellent for widow support.
Yep.
They started a political section because some of us, as we got over the trauma that happens when you lose a spouse, however suddenly, start to develop interests again.
Sure.
And politics over the last 8 or 9 years have been really interesting. And I was severely attacked over quite a few years by some very rigid right-wingers. They claimed to be religious, but they certainly weren't following the teachings of their Lord.
So are you just saying it was ungracious or that it should be illegal? I mean, you put some opinions out there, they put some opinions out there. Is that wrong or is that the American way?
I think what they were doing was wrong. I'm a therapist. I have an online site, and there were things said about me and about my capacity to understand people's issues and problems that were damaging, to put it mildly. It created a lot of emotional distress. A lot of my friends were forced off that board over the years, as I ended up being. I just decided that was enough.
Holly, our time is ticking down. We've got that perspective as well, and we'll pick it up. Let me get one more here and then get back to my guests, Tomiko in Portsmouth, Virginia. Tomiko, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
I just want to say that freedom of speech, yeah, I believe we should have freedom of speech. And freedom of speech to me is basing your, it's, you know, you're speaking your opinion. Freedom of speech is not when you say something is a fact when it's not a fact, that's lying.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're defaming somebody's character, that's not a positive thing. That's not a good thing. And I don't think someone should be allowed to do that. And I think it's something wrong with us as a people if we feel that it's okay for someone to defame someone or to talk about someone, to lie on someone, and for that person to just have to suck it up.
Tomiko, thank you for that view as well. Let us pick all that up. Danielle Citrin, first, is the law adequate here to this challenge of what's going on the web? Do we need changes? Or, you know, can this be dealt with within the current context, including the Communications Decency Act of 1996 that David calls the greatest misnomer in history?
Yeah, no, I think we have some imperfect legal solutions, you know, like claims of defamation, true threats, intentional infliction of emotional distress. They're imperfect because, you know, they're not directly tailored to this kind of cyber sexual harassment that I think I'm focusing on. We have existing civil rights law that may or may not be applicable. And I think the biggest stumbling block is Section 230 and the anonymity of these posters. We have a group of anonymous posters coming together to target, harass, and terrorize individuals. You can't find them. And so, you know, as David so aptly points out in his article, there's such great difficulty in finding posters. And so there's really no one to slow down this abusive behavior. And so it picks up, like David said, like a snowball. What's interesting, though, is that there's some proposals in Congress to require what I call traceable anonymity, that is to require website operators and ISPs to retain IP addresses for a certain extensive period of time. Now, you know, I think there's strong arguments on the other side that this would interfere with free speech, but it certainly would be a step, a deterrent, to know that people have to own their own words quite literally and would be potentially unmasked as long as you met sort of a sufficient, what I would call, real need for strong John Doe subpoenas.
Mm.
So in order to get somebody's name, you know, from an IP address that's been traced, I think in order to protect free speech, to protect, you know, the Publius of the world, the, you know, abused woman who's speaking out online and wants to hide from the spouse, we've got to protect their identities and make sure we have legitimate lawsuits.
Let me turn to Anthony Scioli in the Virgin Islands. Anthony, I mean, you were directly involved here at AutoAdmit. You paid some kind of price in your career. You were a defendant. I guess that's dropped. Now you're suing, as I understand it, Britton Heller and Heidi Iravani and their law firm and this reputation defender. What have you learned from all this, Anthony?
Well, what I've learned from all of this is that it's extremely important to get your side of the story out. One of the most unfortunate things about this whole is the fact that a lot of the actions of Jared Cohen have been imputed onto me, undeservedly, in my opinion, considering that I...
The guy who ran the site, who you worked for. Mm-hmm.
Correct. Concerned especially that I went to considerable effort to get the T14 Talent website, which is the website Heidi Iravani had complained about, an external website that wasn't affiliated with AutoAdmit, to voluntarily shut down.
Do you wish you had done more at AutoAdmit to protect these two women, or do you think you did the right thing?
Honestly, I don't know what I could have done more. I've thought about this question really, really hard for the past 2 years. I just can't think of any other action that I could have taken to facilitate content removal that I hadn't already done. I constantly lobbied Jared to take these threads down. I, you know, in many cases, did take threads down with other people, and I got the Top 14 Towns website shut down. I just can't think of anything else that I could have done to have this situation reach a more amicable solution.
David Margalek, you cite somebody saying, you know, maybe it won't really change until some senator's daughter gets this treatment. What do you see coming? Do you see change,
well,
or is this
you know,
the new world?
Actually, I think that what Anthony says is important because ultimately there are billions of transactions every day online, and the kind of regime that I think Danielle is suggesting is really unmanageable. I mean, there's no way to regulate it. It's just out of control in a sense. And what it requires is precisely the kind of thing that Anthony tried to do at AutoAdmit, which is to get the individual websites to monitor the content that goes on there. And that's one way to calm some of this stuff down. It's self-regulation, and I think probably it's the only solution.
Well, it's also an issue not solved yet, a kind of a new era issue that I am sure we have not heard the last of, but it's been a fascinating introduction or investigation of it today. David Margulis, we want to thank you for your piece, Slimed Online in Portfolio Magazine, that helped us into it. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Mark Randazza in Orlando, Florida. Thank you very much, Attorney Randazza, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Anthony Scioli, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Danielle Citrin at the University of Maryland School of Law. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.